Okay, so today I want to talk about a gene regulatory network, and I'd like to preface this by saying what the object of the exercise is. The object of the exercise is the immodest object of trying to understand why development really happens. The approach being that we know that the code for development is in the genome, and so therefore, in order to accomplish that modest objective, we have to relate the phenomenology of development to the ACGs and Ts in the DNA directly, and that means the regulatory system that is involved, particularly in controlling expression of regulatory genes, that is to say, genes that encode transcription factors. So the network I'm going to be describing to you is mainly a network of interactions amongst regulatory genes. And as this slide says, if you can get it to be reasonably complete, it becomes a highly predictive tool for understanding it. And I will show you that it's a kind of a Rosetta Stone for looking at the phenomenology of development and understanding why it happens. And if I have time at the end of this, I'm going to show you a few of the conclusions that you can draw by looking at a number of different developmental regulatory networks and derive thereby some what you could call principles of system design for gene regulatory networks for development. So let's start with what we're talking about, which is sea urchin development. You saw this picture yesterday, I think. It's a color-coded drawing traced from microscope images of sea urchin embryos. And the first thing you can see is that this is a simple beast. And it's composed entirely of single cell layers, and the colors indicate the different parts of this late gastral stage embryo, about 2 days old. It has a gut, it has a skeleton, that's a biomineral, calcite biomineral, and it has some mesodermal cells, which are pigment cells that we'll talk about, and some other cells that probably have immune functions in the even in the embryo. The lineage and developmental process has been known for a century, and very well for about three quarters of a century. And so we know what cells give rise to what parts of this gastral, and the color coding shows you that. So if you are a microscopist and you're not looking at a molecular biologist colored diagram, if you look at an embryo at this stage, which is the early blastula or a little bit later blastula, it just looks like a featureless hollow ball of cells. You can't see anything. But as the colors show, from very early in development, the cells of this creature are expressing different sets of regulatory genes. They have different regulatory states, shall we say. And those states determine the outcome later on in development of this progeny of these cells. So the red cells, there are four of them at this stage, of which two are shown here, become the cells that produce the skeleton. The blue cells produce the gut, and the purple cells produce these mesenchymal cells. And the green and yellow parts are ectodermal. This is a neurogenic territory at the top. The network I'm going to be talking about just goes up to the period between 24 and 30 hours before any of these parts of the embryo are formed. And it just concerns the cells that make the skeleton, the skeletogenic cells, the cells that make the gut, the endoderm cells, and the cells that make the mesoderm. So it's this part of the embryo only. And as you will see, it's still requires quite a lot of regulatory apparatus to do that job. And the job in question is, what is it that specifies those cells? And when developmental biologists use the word specify, they mean alter the regulatory state of the cells in such a way that it expresses a specific set of transcription factors. Yeah. Depends on the type of embryogenesis. Most embryos develop in a way similar to this. It's the most basic and widespread form of embryogenesis in which there's no migration of cells until after specification. And there's a fixed cell lineage. Most marine embryos do this. Not all. There's some highly evolved forms like octopuses, for example, that operate much more like vertebrate embryos do. In vertebrate embryos and some other embryos, there's no specification until after massive cell migrations. In fact, the genomes don't even run from early on. Well, in this form, the genomes open up at once on fertilization. And Drosophila is still a third kind of embryogenesis where there's a syncytial system. So, those are three differences. But they can all be related to the same set of specification functions. Look at my current book as a comparative description of that. So let's go a little more deeply into this. And this is what I call a process diagram, which is the way to start in building gene regulatory networks. And what it is basically the kind of layout that you would have to do if you were going to design a program to do what has to be done. You might start this way. This is, in fact, how we started some version of this. So we know that there's a skeletogenic territory. We know there must be something different about those cells, these red cells, because embryologists have shown that if you remove them from the embryo, as soon as they're born and put them in culture, they'll make skeleton. They won't do anything else. So there's something localized in them that we'll just call some initial anisotropy. And there have to be, in order for anything to happen because of that, there have to be some regulatory genes which respond to whatever those cues are and constitute an initial early state of specification. And then downstream of that, there have to be some regulatory genes that actually run the skeletogenic gene batteries, which are the differentiation genes that make the biomineral. And the same for the mesodermal and the endodermal regions. And we also include in this the fact from experimental embryology that unlike in Drosophila, because there are no cells early on, in sea urchin, signaling between cells begins at once. And that's typical of this type of embryogenesis too. And it's known, and there are two signals that I have to tell you about that are very important. A signal here means specifically and literally a situation in which a protein ligand is stuck out through the membrane of the cell giving a signal, and it's received by a specific receptor on the membrane of the adjacent cell. And I'm not talking about anything that diffuses anywhere except to the next cell. And this is all short-range signaling in this embryo. And so the one signal is a signal emitted by the skeletogenic cells, which are here, and that signal goes to the cells at this stage, right next door, and it's that which turns the adjacent cells into future mesodermal cells. And that signal is through the notch signaling system, which some of you know about. So delta is the ligand. And so there has to be in the mesodermal cells some signal reception devices which are upstream of mesodermal differentiation. So you can say things like that, and you know that there are boxes into which regulatory genes must exist. And so that's a good way to start, because then superimposed on that information as to when and where the regulatory genes in the system are expressed provides you with an initial set of organizing principles, so to speak. So this is the current form of the network, and there are about 40 regulatory genes in that network, and the form of it, for those of you who aren't used to looking at these things, is the following, that each little horizontal line represents a cis-regulatory domain that is predicted to exist with the inputs indicated by the vertical arrows or barred stems in the case of a repression, and the outputs indicated by what comes off the bent arrow at the end of the line. So for example, the OTX gene, the name of it is here, has inputs into these other genes, wherever the purple lines go. And the GATA-E gene has inputs, one of which is a feedback on OTX, as you can see here. And the most important point about this is it provides us with a direct prediction, which is testable at the cis-regulatory level, of what we would find in the DNA if we looked in terms of cis-regulatory target sites. So we should find a target site for the green input, the purple input, and this, whatever color that is, mauve input in the beta cis-regulatory module of the OTX gene. You'll notice that much of this diagram is shown in with thick lines, and every thick line in here has been verified directly at the cis-regulatory level by taking out these cis-regulatory modules and showing mutationally that the inputs are there and are responsible for the function of the gene as expected. So this is what we call network authentication, and much of this network is authenticated at this point by that method, and probably all of the important nodes of it will be within a year or so. It turns out the way that the network was originally formulated was on the basis of three kinds of information. One, where and when all those genes are expressed, which enables one to apply a few simple logic rules. For example, if a gene is expressed in domain A and it has an effect on a gene in domain B, we know very well that's an indirect effect via signal. And if it's expressed 20 hours earlier, A is expressed 20 hours earlier than B, we know, and it has an effect on B, we know that they're intermediary steps, so we can use information like that. And mainly, massive perturbation analysis in which the expression of every gene was interrupted by injection of an antisense oligonucleotide substituted with a chemical called morpholino, which makes it resistant to degradation. So that, and this turns out to be in this and many other kinds of organism, like zebrafish, for instance, or frogs, is a very effective way of knocking out gene expression. Yeah, specifically. In this organism, there's about a 2 to 3 hour interval from step to step. So from the time regulatory gene 1 goes on to the time that regulatory gene 2 goes on, it's 2 to 3 hours. And we've modeled that, and that's about what it is. What were you going to say? Yeah, we sure can. Yeah. Most of them are AND functions. They're not all AND functions, but in development, these are typically, you can almost think of them as Boolean operators that add inputs or you get nothing out. And so, sometimes you get an additive OR. Yes. There's an implicit crude timeline that goes from top to bottom, as in this diagram, early to late. Yeah.
How important is the strength of expression of
part? None of these genes are expressed strongly, so it's typical of transcription factors. All of the in this organism and in many organisms, the level of transcription factors in development is all in the range between, say, 10 and 50 molecules of message per cell. That's a pretty low level. None of them are expressed strongly. And I mean, something that's expressed strongly will have several hundred molecules or more of message per cell. These are not too big cells, but so there are no, and we have shown in detail that the level of expression that the next gene down in a gene cascade, you go from gene 1 to gene 2 to gene 3 to gene 4, the next gene down starts off long before steady state is ever reached. So this is a forward drive system that is not dependent on the establishment of a particular level, in contrast to many physiological systems. Okay? Yeah. I'm going to show you exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Well, a good rule of, it depends, of course, on protein turnover, but a rule of thumb is that there are about 2 molecules of protein made per minute message. So another thing I could tell you is that in order to get a sufficient number of molecules of a transcription factor in the cell to occupy the target site for a typical random transcription factor, about 1,000 molecules or so is required. So therefore, only a rather modest number of molecules of message is quite sufficient to produce that number of molecules of protein, given the number of hours that exist. To what? All it has to do is go in the nucleus, and the diffusion, the nucleus is small enough so that by diffusion it will find its target immediately. Yeah. You can consider it's everything is open. If you put something in the system, it will work. It's a diffusion limited system. Yeah. Are what? Well, this one you'll notice is a 1A and 1B. We're looking at this is the maximum bird's eye view of the network where you can see all the connections. And so there's a lot of information in it that is not very explicit. So these are actually 2 different cis-regulatory modules, the one called 1A and 1B. And there are 3 or 4 inputs into each one. As you saw in Endo-16 analysis yesterday, there are a lot of inputs into each cis-regulatory module. And as I was saying yesterday, in answer to a question, a good average number is 4 to 8 different inputs into a developmentally active cis-regulatory module. Now, in many cases, you only see one here. That's because we only know of that one. And so particularly the thin line places that haven't been investigated at the cis-regulatory level yet may have further inputs. But a lot of the inputs that are not present here, which you saw a lot of in Endo-16, are inputs from factors which are globally present and which are not spatially confined. So this is what we call a driver gene network, which concerns the regulatory genes that are differentially regulated, so they're expressed in this place or in this place, for the which is the endomesoderm, this is the skeletogenic region. And in other words, they're not universally present because, as logic tells you, in order to explain why something's expressed only skeletogenically, you must consider the things that are expressed specifically there and not things that are expressed everywhere. So those are implicit, but they're not shown. Yes?
Is there an age of the factor after
Oh, yes. Everything turns over continuously. So nothing here, and I'll get to this, the only lockdowns are dynamic. They're continuing interactions. That go, so everything is turning over all the time. Yes. That's one of the worst problems in this whole business is the difficulty in measuring and the heterogeneity in protein turnover rates. The RNAs are easy to deal with. Because I deal with RNAs, so they're easy for me, but and I don't deal with proteins, so they're hard for me, but their proteins are a zoo. Yes. This whole network? Well, we've gotten a lot better at it, and one of my postdocs did a cis regulatory analysis of one of these nodes the other day in 3 weeks. So you can really motor now with good with current technology. Yeah. This Eve? Yes, this one. No, it's just. This is a. If you go to our website, you'll see a version. You can find versions of this where you can see just what's happening in each portion at each point in time. So, if you click on the region that's just this, you can see what's active at that time, what's active a few hours later, what's active a few hours later, and the same here. This is what we call the view from the genome, in which all of the interactions are summed. And there's a useful thing about it because at a glance you can see what you would see if you looked in the genomic DNA. In BRCA you'd expect to see these inputs in the genomic DNA whenever it happens. And so this is a view that basically tells you what you're going to find in the DNA. It's not the developmental biologist view, but I would have to show you 40 different pictures at different times in order to, which is clumsy to do in a talk. Yeah. So this just means that Eve is expressed in this domain, and Eve is expressed in this domain also. And that's the same gene. Oh, to Drosophila. I'm sorry, I didn't get your question. Yeah, it's a quite different role. It's an entirely different function. I mean, it's a transcription factor. It's the same orthologous gene. But transcription, don't be surprised. Transcription factors do dozens of things in the life cycle of each organism. And I could show you, but I want to get on to other things, so I want to go ahead if I can. I'm going to answer your question too. But I could show you a piece of data that shows that 80% of all the transcription factors in the genome are used just to make an embryo up to this stage. Which means one very simple fact. It means that they're used over and over and over and over again as the embryo gets, as the organism gets much more complex. Yeah. I'm going to get to that in just a moment. Thank you. So, yes. Ubiquitous means that that's an input that's everywhere in the organism. Those are different proteins, yes, and they're not explicitly shown. Okay, so there are two. So when anybody shows you a network, there are two questions to ask about: how complete is it, and what about its authenticity? So this kind of network differs from what you'll often see in pictures from genetic epistasis experiments, where an arrow goes from one gene to another or something, which has sometimes, but often, does not imply a direct interaction, which means that you're going to find a target site for some particular thing in that particular cis regulatory domain. It could be four steps removed. This is presumes to be direct interactions. So in other words, it presumes to tell you what is the DNA code. And as I've pointed out, much of this network has been authenticated. Now, as far as completeness is concerned, the Searchin genome was recently sequenced, and so we we investigated computationally every predicted protein that could be a transcription factor. Transcription factors have highly conserved DNA binding domains across the bioteria. They're almost all recognizable. Rarely today do you see a paper that says a new kind of transcription factor was just discovered. And so most transcription factors can be recognized at the sequence level. And we tested by real-time quantitative PCR expression of every transcription factor that was predicted in the genome. That was about 280 transcription factors of all classes that were not zinc fingers, and an equal number, or a little bit more than that, of C2H2 zinc fingers. And all transcription factors which were expressed early enough in embryogenesis to possibly have anything to do with these gene regulatory networks we studied. So that measurement gives you the number of molecules per embryo, and all those expressed significantly. We investigated where they were expressed, and so we know all the transcription factors that are expressed in the skeletogenic, the mesodermal, and the endodermal domain of the embryo. And so all of those are now being put into the embryo, into the network. Oh, sorry, they're in the embryo. But the good news is that there are only a few of them. So there are three or four more transcription factors, and later this week you'll see a version of the network posted that includes them in a sort of intermediate position down here in this network. And there are three or four more skeletogenic factors. There's about five more mesodermal factors and similar endodermal. And then this network will be approaching this strange thing for a biologist to say, which is completeness. But, yes. Say what? There's all kinds of biochemistry downstream of this. This is, let's call this the first line of regulation. And so, as I said at the outset, what this is about is, what is the DNA code for development? And I don't know what the role of microRNAs in this very early process is, but what has been, and you can ask Nicolaus, who's a world expert on this, but the studies that have been done in zebrafish and in Drosophila do not indicate that this is decisive for producing the body plan in embryogenesis. And Dicer, for example, doesn't even get expressed in this thing until after the stage I'm dealing with. Yes. Say what? There is some, but nonetheless, that's true. That's true. Yeah. So a lot of those things which are things like CBP and so forth are ubiquitously present. And so there are some which are not ubiquitously present, which are not DNA binding proteins, which are regulated in their expression, and we're going to miss those in this analysis. Occasionally, you find a transcription factor that's expressed and you cannot find what it does. Occasionally. There's one factor we found that's not on this picture because we don't know what its role is, that's expressed in the skeletogenic cells quite actively, but you take it out and absolutely nothing changes. But that's a rare, it happens, it's a rare event, and I think the usual explanation for it is that it has inputs which are present here, but it will later be expressed next door, and there it does have a function, and it's using the same inputs. And so, I think that that's the nature of that phenomenon, and we have a couple of examples of that, where there's always a later function, but the genes which have targets for that are not included in this network. Yeah. Gene, if a gene duplication occurs, and it's really an evolutionary question, if a gene duplication occurs in near time, it will have a similar regulatory input. It won't make much difference at all. It will either one of those copies of genes will disappear, or they will cross-react, or they will get useful, or something will change in its regulatory in the regulation of one of them, and usually. In vertebrates, there's a lot known about transcription factors that were duplicated. They're almost always expressed in non-coincident domains sooner or later. But I really don't want to discuss that evolutionary issue today because I'm going to talk about evolution next week, and we could enjoyably spend the rest of the morning doing that. But, so I want to go on to other things. Yeah. I mean, I want to talk about it, but not today. Yeah.
You were talking about surrogates before, maybe before.
Yes.
You need more to lean on the female family because you have these kinds of reverse
experiments
in which you
are. Yes, we do those, but I don't like those experiments. They're, with transcription factors, they're dangerous because transcription factors bind different sets of target sites because of target site divergence among the genes that have them, depending on their concentration. And it's very hard in an overexpression experiment to get the concentration right, to get it normal in the right cells. And although the relation is an exponential one between concentration and occupancy, nonetheless, it's most of the overexpression experiments you see in the literature, particularly, for instance, in Xenopus, are like 10 molar transcription factor with 100 abnormal targets being engaged. And so if you take something out, you really don't have that problem nearly as badly. So we do that mostly for repressors, where you don't have this problem. You have it too, but it's some way more easy to deal with. Yes. Well, let me just time out. I just want to get to my next point, which is it looks complicated as the Dickens, but it's actually a modular structure. It's made of subunits, and I want to spend the rest of this time talking about the subunits, which are much more easily comprehended. And so let me do that, and then come back. Let's come back to it. So that's exactly what I want to talk about. So my view is that if you want to understand development, you need to understand the network subcircuits, and each subcircuit. So if you're a developmental biologist, you can say what's going on. Well, specification is going on. That's a developmental job. Signal interpretation is going on. That's a developmental job. Cells are becoming skeletogenic. That's a developmental job. So those kinds of things that the biologist sees all turn out to be explicable in terms of specific subcircuits of which this overrun network is composed. And of course, what the job they do depends on the architecture, and the architecture depends on the CIS regulatory target site. So in that sense, it's at this level that the regulatory genome is functionally interpretable. And this last point is what I want to talk about next week in considering gene networks and evolution, but not today. So what I'm going to do is show you a few examples of phenomena of development. And most developmental biology, if you must face it, that we've grown up with is phenomenology. And we want to explain it. And so I'm going to show you some phenomena, all interesting, important phenomena, and show you how network subcircuits encode these phenomena. So the first one is a dramatic one. It was noticed in the late 90s by Dave McClay and others that if you take a antibody against a transcriptional cofactor called beta-catenin and stain embryos with it, that certain nuclei in the early embryo, beginning at about fifth cleavage, have concentrations of this transcriptional cofactor that are dramatically visible in the nuclei of the cells, which you see as white balls here. Here's a diagram. And what's interesting, what's fascinating about it, is that every cell that becomes part of the endomesoderm, which is to say a skeletogenic cell, or a mesodermal cell, or a gut cell, is a cell that descends from one of these with beta-catenin nuclearized, and no other cells do so. So it's a one-to-one correlation, and if that nuclearization is prevented from occurring, which could be done by trapping a beta-catenin in the cytoplasm so it can't go in the nucleus, then instead of getting an embryo with a gut and pigment cells and so forth, and the skeleton, you just get a gutless wonder, just a ball of ectoderm, basically. So not only is there a perfect correlation, but there's also obviously something important required. What does that phenomenon mean? So here's what the phenomenon means. This is a subcircuit from one corner of that big network. And there are two very interesting things about this subcircuit. First of all, it's driven, it starts off initially by a maternal anisotropy, so there's something different, which is known but I'm not going to go into, about the cortex of the egg and the vegetal part from which the endomesoderm derives, and some small amount of beta-catenin is initially released from the docking locations on the cortex into the nuclei in the beginning. And after that, the nuclearization that you see is driven by an intracellular feedback circuit, which is driven by this gene that encodes a Wnt8 ligand. So Wnt8 is a ligand that's picked up by recipient cells, and through some intracellular biochemistry, it causes more beta-catenin to be released, and where it binds the transcription factor TCF, goes in the nucleus, and then it causes the Wnt8 gene to be expressed further. So if you think about it for a minute, since Wnt8 diffuses the next cell, you realize that every cell is linked to every other cell in the following way, that every cell expresses Wnt8, the adjacent cell receives a signal, drives the Wnt8 gene, so it expresses Wnt8 back, and so all the cells throughout the endomesoderm are locked in a continuously, in a stimulating circuit of this, and which has the function of ensuring that TCF, which is targeted to a number of other genes in the network, is going to be there in its active form, which has beta-catenin with it. There's another aspect of this is that same transcription factor, if it does not have beta-catenin bound to it, has an obligate repressor bound to it, and so outside of the endomesoderm, not only does the TCF input lacking, but every gene that has target sites for it will be actively turned off because this acts as a repressor. So it's a kind of a logic toggle switch, which is common for signaling systems, as I'll show you another example later. So that's the first point. And the reason why you get this, if you stop that, is because downstream of TCF are many, many linkages into different genes, and every one of these blue lines is a TCF input into some gene. And so the blue lines run all over the upper part of this diagram. And so the reason you don't get an endomesoderm if you stop that is because of the number of TCF inputs. But that's just the beginning, and I just want to show you what I mean by authentication. So we would like to, the presumption then is if I isolate the Wnt8 cis-regulatory module, I'll find a TCF beta-catenin input target site in it, which is necessary for its function. So this is just an experiment that was done by one of my postdocs, Takuya Minakawa. And you see here a cis-regulatory module, which existed right here. These are the exons of the gene attached to a reporter, which we visualize the product of in blue here. It's injected into the egg. The reporter runs in the right place. But if you mutate the target site for TCF in that reporter, it doesn't run at all. So we know that that is, in fact, true. There is a target site for TCF in the Wnt8. And so we know a lot more about it, too. So never comes on. Okay, so that's only part of what this subcircuit does. And it's actually gets more and more interesting. And we notice that a number of genes have a dynamic moving pattern of expression, if you look at the embryo from the bottom, including Wnt8, and including, you may have noticed that there's another gene in this picture called Crox, actually misnamed, it's BLIMP1. Things change every year. And the output from Crox is also required in the Wnt8 cis-regulatory domain, also authenticated at the cis-regulatory level. So Crox, Wnt8, and three or four other genes do this. If you look at them, they start in the skeletogenic micromeres, then this torus of expression goes off in the micromeres and spreads to the adjacent mesodermal cells, and then it goes off there and spreads to the adjacent future endodermal cells. And this takes some hours to occur, but it's a spreading, it's a phenomenon, another phenomenon. It's a dynamic torus of gene expression. So it turns out that this subcircuit explains that too. And you're seeing the same, it's basically what you saw before, the addition of one other gene, and a key point that was there but not, that I didn't mention in the last picture. And that is that, let's now look at the BLIMP gene, which, just to be confusing, is called Crox here, same gene. It has an input that goes into Wnt8, as I showed you. This symbol means that Wnt8 is activated, this gene, as are all TCF beta-catenin targets, activated in cells which are receiving that ligand, repressed in any other cells, but the BLIMP1 gene also receives the same input, which is the TCF beta-catenin input. So these guys have an interesting relation, and BLIMP1 requires OTX, which is a very early transcription factor that's present throughout this domain. So BLIMP1 has one other feature, and that is that it represses itself. So if you look at this for a minute, you realize that that means it's going to go up and come down again. It's going to make a temporal peak of expression because the transcription factor will be, the gene will be transcribed, the transcription factor will be translated, it will accumulate, it will go back in the nucleus, it will repress the gene, then it will shut itself off. So it's going to make, in fact, unless something else happens, it will oscillate. And so there are a number of genes that we have that do that. Yeah?
The BLIMP1 negative group can
Has a what? Now, the thick thin doesn't refer to this diagram. Sorry, that was just. This has all been. I'll show you the experiment in just a moment. May I? The mutational experiment. Okay. So it occurred to us that, and this is mainly Joel Smith's work. It occurred to us that this auto-repression and this sub-circuit could account for this function of shutting this whole system off in the middle, because WNT8, when it's synthesized, will diffuse to the next cell, next cell layer, and so there will be a tendency to cause the regions that are being expressing this whole system to expand, but once LIMP1 has gone on, it will turn itself off, and so that could account for that. So here's what it looks like in real life. This is the endogenous LIMP1 gene. It makes a real torus, just as I showed you. Now here's an experiment where the BLIMP1, this is the experiment I think that Steve's asking me about. The BLIMP1 target sites are mutated, and now we look and see on the reporter that BLIMP1 expression now occurs in the middle of this place. This is the reporter in dark blue and the endogenous in light blue. So it is in fact responsible for keeping BLIMP1 out of the middle of that torus. And here's a really neat experiment, same subcircuit, where the cis regulatory module of BLIMP1 was mutated for its BLIMP target sites. The TCF sites remain there. And then what we did was attach to that mutated construct a cDNA that encodes the BLIMP protein. So what we're doing now is causing the BLIMP transcription factor to be present in the middle of the torus. And now you can ask the question, does that now take a target gene like WNT8, which is linked to this, and put it in the middle of the torus? This is looking at embryo at the side. And either endogenous WNT8, or in this case a back construct with a GFP reporter knocked into it, its expression now spreads into what was the middle of the torus instead of being out in the side when you do that. So basically, these and other experiments show you that subcircuit accounts for what happens. And it's so there's this initial nuclearization of beta-catenin. BLIMP1 goes on, and WNT8 goes on. WNT8 signals to the next cell, which signals back, so these cells get locked into this feedback. BLIMP1 turns itself off, and the system dies. But in the meantime, WNT8 is diffused to the next tier of cells, and the same thing repeats itself. And so that's a great example of how statically encoded set of DNA sequences accounts for this pattern of expression, essentially. I think that's a neat example. Yes. Yeah, good question. Well, because as soon as the WNT8 disappears, WNT8 ligand is no longer being received by those cells, then the repressor that I mentioned will sit on TCF, reoccupies that site. And so it shuts everything, it makes it impossible for those genes to be activated again. There may be other things that happen as well, but that's one thing that happens. Yeah, it's about 4 hours per step or so. Well, it's a function partly of how long it takes for the biochemistry to happen, and the biochemistry is the same in all these cells. Yeah.
So, what is the function of this phenomenon of the auto-learning?
Well, so, downstream of the TCF beta-catenin and of BLIMP1 are a number of other genes that are connected to it that, that need those inputs in those different layers of cells or different rings of cells. So, I mean, this is showing you what the driver of a set of other genes is doing. If it were a disc. Well, that's a good question, but by the time that, so I can answer that question, let me see what I have next here. Yeah, okay, I can answer that question when I get to the next section of this talk. So I told you another phenomenon before, which is that if you cut the micromeres, the skeletogenic cells off the embryo and put them in culture, they'll sit there and they'll make skeletons as long as you don't kill them. So what is skeletogenic stratification? That's a prominent phenomenon in C. urchin embryos. So here's what it is. It turns out that it's mediated in a counterintuitive way by this subcircuit that's in red here. So what happens is there's a repression of a repressor. And so if you would have asked me before we found any of this out what happens, I would have said, well, the micromeres must have something special in them, because if you cut them off, they develop autonomously. So maybe they have a gene regulatory protein in them that turns on micromere-specific genes. But that's a positively acting image of something stored in them. But they have instead, they don't have that at all. Instead, they have the initial nuclearization of the beta-catenin from the maternal one, and they also initially nuclearize OTX by some cytoplasmic mechanism unknown. And Paolo Oliveri in our lab discovered that the initial target of this is a repressor which represses another repressor, and this repressor, which we now know what it is, as I'll show you, is active all over the egg. So basically what happens is that in micromeres, the second repressor is turned off and the downstream targets are therefore off, but in the rest of the embryo, the second repressor keeps all the downstream targets off. So only in the micromeres are the downstream targets allowed to run. So here's an example of one of the downstream targets. It's this gene delta, and it runs normally, just exquisitely precisely, the micromere descendants. But if we put this message for PMAR1 throughout the egg, then delta runs all over the egg. So that means that delta must have a ubiquitous input. It allows it to run all over the egg if it's not repressed there. Okay, so that's the proposition. Now, the point of this is that there are three transcription factors which are the upstream specification apparatus for skeletogenic cells, and they are all repressed everywhere in the embryo except in the micromeres. This is a very strange piece of jury-rigged wiring. The explanation for it is really evolutionary, and I'll discuss that next week, but that's the way it works anyway. And so it's a double repression, and if that's true, then any one of these things should be able to be expressed anywhere in the embryo by simply expressing PMAR1. In fact, the whole embryo should turn into skeletogenic cells if you do that, and it does. So if you inject PMAR1 into the embryo, for instance, here's T-brain, one of these transcription factors expressed throughout the embryo instead of just in the micromeres where it's supposed to be. And if you leave these embryos alone, they all become mesenchymal, and the junctions between the cells fall apart, and so the embryo just becomes basically a puddle of skeletogenic cells sooner or later. Yes? Is what? Well, no, that's what I'm going to talk about next week. But the answer is that only the echinoids among the five echinoderm classes do this. So it's a recent evolutionary piece of wiring. Recently means probably since the Triassic-Permian extinction about 250 million years ago. Huh? I'll show you exactly what it is in a minute. Okay, so if this is true, just speaking of authentication, we ought to be able to find a delta cis-regulatory domain, and it should have the same response in a reporter experiment to PMR1 injection as the gene does, right? So I showed you this yesterday, an intraspecific sequence comparison, the conserved patch that represents one of the many conserved patches that delta has, which happens to drive expression specifically in skeletogenic cells, the GFP reporter being turned on in those cells when this is attached to it. And in a experiment in which PMR1 has been injected into the egg, instead of being confined just to those skeletogenic cells, it runs all over the egg. So this piece of DNA does the right thing. So now about the repressor. The prediction of this is the following, that if I were to, the logical prediction is that if I were to stop its expression, then it should be the same thing as injecting PMR1, right? So morpholino antisense oligonucleotide against this repressor of micromere functions should give me the same phenotype, which is global expression of these genes, or of this reporter, as injection of PMR1 message. And furthermore, it should be expressed everywhere in the embryo except in the micromeres. So here it is. It's HESC. It's a repressive transcription factor of BHLH family. This is a marker for where the micromeres are that express delta, as you saw. And here's where HESC is expressed, everywhere except the micromeres. Here's a double in situ. It's a very pretty picture. And if I put PMR1 into the egg, as I showed you, delta is expressed everywhere. And if I put HESC morpholino into the embryo, delta is expressed everywhere. So this is the repressor of micromeres. It has all of the characteristics that would be predicted on the basis of logic from the network analysis. So this is... The morpholino may not be fully affected, and that's an experimental variable. But you can see it's quite a difference between this and this. I think the fact that it has all of the predicted characteristics is pretty cool, and that's what we find with this network, that it's complete enough so that the logic that is predicted for every piece of it turns out to be true. So I'm going to show you two more phenomena that we can now understand that in terms of the genomic code for subcircuit architecture. That's really my mantra here. And one of them is that the first of these is, as I mentioned before, that in order to get those mesodermal cells specified, it's known that the micromeres or skeletogenic cells have to emit this ligand delta encoded by that gene. It goes to next door cells and turns them into future mesodermal cells. But what does that mean? So this is what it means. And here's delta that you just saw. And delta is a ligand for notch, which is a receptor. And as many of you here know, The way notch signaling works is that when the receptor binds a ligand, then a change occurs so that an intracellular piece of that receptor is enzymatically cleaved off, and it binds a transcription factor that's already present called suppressor of hairless. And the network analysis predicted that a gene which in Drosophila is called glial cells missing, this has nothing to do with glial cells, is the primary target but that's a good example of what Steve mentioned, that we wouldn't know about that gene except it was revealed by Drosophila developmental genetics. But we know that, and all bioterians have it, and sea urchins have it, and they use it for this. And so here again, it is the primary target, according to network analysis, of this notch signaling system. And it has the additional feature that once it gets activated, it auto-stimulates itself. So it locks itself on, doesn't auto-repress itself, auto-stimulates itself. Downstream of it, and we don't know whether in several of these cases, except for this one, whether these are direct inputs, are a number of, as a differentiation gene battery, which includes proteins that make pigment of pigment cells. Pigment cells are dramatic-looking cells in sea urchin embryo. These are what they look like. They're embedded in the aboral ectoderm, and they probably have an immune function. And if you look early on, so according to this, glial cells missing is the recipient of the signal. So glial cells missing, I showed you this picture yesterday, is expressed in this ring of cells that's directly adjacent to the cells that are making delta, which is these cells in the middle, and only that one ring of cells. So this again is a short-range signaling. It's not a diffusible signal, and this transcription factor continues to be expressed at the point where the cells move into the ectoderm and make pigment, and they make these red cells. So if you stop GCM from being expressed, you get an albino embryo. If you stop delta from being expressed, you get an albino embryo. If you stop notch from functioning, you get an albino embryo. And if you stop this transcription factor from functioning, you get an albino embryo, like that. It's perfectly normal, but it just doesn't have any pigment cells. So we should be able to find then a cis-regulatory module of GCM that has notch termini, signaling termini. And this is, here are the ACGs and Ts, and these are the suppressor hairless sites. And if mutated, they entirely prevent glial cells missing from going on in the right place. But they have the additional feature that this acts as a logic toggle switch, just like the Wnt system does. Because where, and this is also true in Drosophila, and it was first discovered in Drosophila, that where suppressive hairless, if it's in a cell that's not receiving a notch input, then it binds an obligate repressor and it turns off, it represses actively any gene that has target sites for that. So the consequence is that if you were to mutate those sites, you get ectopic expression all over the embryo of glial cells missing. While normally, if they're not mutated, it keeps that gene off in the ectoderm, and it's permitted to run only in the mesodermal cells, which receive that signal. This is now not the endogenous gene, but this piece of DNA attached to a GFP reporter. So again, we can see in the DNA the sequences that do this job. And finally, I want to discuss something else, which is another phenomenon. What does it mean to specify endoderm? So the initial step in this is a very interesting and peculiar circuit. And this is going to be part of the theme of my talk next week on an evolutionary topic, but I want you to look at this for just a moment. So what happens is that this Crox or blimp gene goes on. It goes on first. It turns on one of the cis-regulatory modules of the OTX, which is also a different transcription start site. And this gene not only locks itself on, but feeds back on Crox for a little while. Now then, as I told you, which isn't included, as I told you, Crox eventually shuts itself off, which is dominant. So this goes away after a while. But it kicks off OTX. OTX activates GATA-E. GATA-E feeds back on the same cis regulatory module. It also has a number of other downstream targets together with OTX, which are high up in the endoderm specification hierarchy and are really necessary for all the rest that happens. If any one of these, if expression of any one of these genes is interrupted, you get an embryo with no gut. Any one of them. So, and you can see that it would be true from the way it's wired up, because they're all these genes depend on each other. Well, you can't see that. There's no feedback from these, but expression of any of these, and the reason that happens for these is because downstream endoderm genes depend on their inputs. So we call this little feedback circuit a kernel of the network. And it has fascinating properties, some of which I'll show you in a moment. So one of its fascinating properties is its evolutionary conservation. And because echinoderms have an endoskeleton, they have a very good fossil record. And so we know that the last common ancestor between sea urchins and starfish was one of the earliest forms of echinoderms that crawls along, that's mobile. The Cambrian echinoderms were all stalked, they stuck in the bottom. And this animal lived about 500 million years ago, and since then, this line of evolution and this line of evolution have been entirely independent. So there's two 500 million year courses of evolution. That's a very long time that these have been evolving independently. So one of my courageous postdocs, which was Veronica Hinman, tamed a local starfish for laboratory purposes and discovered and did an analysis of the network organization for endoderm specification in the starfish. And here's this little kernel of the endoderm specification system in the sea urchin you just looked at, that 5-gene subcircuit. And here is almost the same thing in the starfish. What's in common is shown here. And what's in common is almost all of it. There's a couple of small differences and one very big difference. And the biggest difference has to do with this brain, gene T-brain, which I mentioned earlier is one of the skeletogenic genes under PMAR1 control. But in the starfish, it is involved in this endoderm specification system. And I'm going to discuss that next week, so don't ask me about today. We know a lot about that. I'll tell you about it next week. But the main thing I want to point out today is the architecture of this subcircuit is entirely conserved. So OTX activates GATA-E. GATA-E feeds back. Blimp 1 or Crox turns on OTX. OTX feeds back. And this also auto-represses itself, not shown here. Brachyury and Foxa are both downstream of these things. So that's just a remarkable example of conservation of a large number of linkages. And so we know that this is not only an interesting looking subcircuit, but it must be very important because it survived for 500 million years of independent evolution. And nothing else in the surrounding network is the same, by the way. So that's why I said in the beginning of this talk, I said that subcircuits evolve at different rates. And this is an example of a kind of subcircuit that evolves at very, very slow rates compared to a lot of very pliable aspects of this wiring. And so, yeah. How do I what? I can't hear what you said. I didn't say nothing else, but we have, I'll show you that next week. We have a lot of other linkages that are different. Okay, so that's all I was going to, I could show you the cis regulatory analysis of this, and we know that every one of these inputs is there. They've all been tested by mutation. In fact, that was the example I gave you of an AND logic processor in my talk yesterday. Yes? I don't know. The part of endoderm specification that seems, it's certainly not in Joel's endoderm C. elegans system as far as I can tell, although the GATA factors are very much involved in endoderm stressification in that, and as they are in everywhere. And this, I don't know how widely conserved it is outside of this clade. I'll bet you it's in hemichordates, which is the sister phylum of this group, from some bad evidence. But I don't know how wide it will be conserved. It turns out that just downstream of this are a series of transcription factors that operate a little bit later in gut development that seem to be also conserved throughout the vertebrates, for instance. Now, these are deuterostomes. It may be pan-deuterostome. It may be just echinoderm plus hemichordate. No. So these are dedicated to these functions, yes.
Can one get this situation bioinformatically?
Well, what?
Can one move this analysis by pure bioinformatics instead of doing surrogate?
I wish.
But
the answer is no, and I wish. Yeah, you can't do it any cheap and easy way like microarray analysis. Feedbacks are notoriously invisible to microarray analysis, and our databases for predicting transcription factor target sites, to be polite, suck. And so you cannot do what you really need to do. Oh, once you know what the inputs are, the databases are great. I mean, they'll tell you it's this or this or this or this, which is a subset of a world of sequence. And so since you have a piece of DNA that's this long that gives proper expression in the endoderm at the right time, you can find it. Then you mutate it. Yeah, pretty much. And if you don't, then you can do it the hard way, which is just chop up the sequence until you lose the function. But usually what we do is use oligonucleotide mapping, which gives you a pretty good idea, by gel shifts, if we need to. But we need to less and less. So the database are fine if you have a little piece of DNA and you know what you're looking for, but they're terrible if you just don't know anything a priori. Yes. Huh? Yeah. We haven't done them with this because for us the final answer is the mutational answer, since it directly interrogates what I want to know, which is the meaning of the DNA sequence. We have not used that type of analysis because we can do mutational cis regulatory analysis. Yes. Hold on a second, I'll show you the answer to that. Here's the dynamics. So the first thing that happens is Crox is one of the is a maternal form of OTX turnzone crox together with TCF, which isn't shown here. And the next thing that happens is that the OTX turns on GATA E and OTX and crox turns on OTX, and then this feedback loop is set up subsequently, and then crox goes off because it turns itself off. Say what? Yes. Oh, okay. Sorry. Let me get back to this. So, very crudely, time goes from top to bottom here. So, this just goes up to the point before gastrulation. And after gastrulation, these genes up here aren't required anymore. GATA-E, FOXA, and GATA-E and FOXA now run a series of downstream genes that haven't even gone into play yet, that aren't on this map. And so there's another level, exactly, there's another level just before gastrulation, which is some new genes, about five genes to be added in. And then after gastrulation, there's a whole slew of 10 more transcription factors going, and they're the ones that build and partition that got into three segments. So this is just the specification of endogen that you're looking at here. Yeah. Well, for instance, we knew there was something we called R of a repressor of micromeres, and we predicted what its characteristics would be. So, but we also, for example, the program that this is done in, the computational platform, is called BioTapestry, which you can find in our website. And the most interesting part of that question is what can be done at an automated, what can be done by machines in terms of building these networks? And so within a few months, we'll have a version of that which will take the following information. Given that you understand the developmental biology, so you know what cell is where, and time course of expression of the transcription factor, spatial expression, and perturbation results, and those three things together, by application of some logic rules, can go pretty far for building these networks. And so now you need some logic rules, like, for example, if a gene is expressed in one cell and it affects in perturbation a gene in another cell, you know it's not a direct input. And there are a number of other kinds of logic rules that you have to apply. But I think that those three kinds of information, together with what you might call ordinary developmental biology basis that enables you to build a process diagram like I showed you, that box diagram, it will be possible to build networks automatically. Right now, we use the best computer, but which is our heads. But yes.
Well, you study hybridization. Obviously, there's lots of other all of those factors are as such. So
in this case,
you say that all those things say all do not change their state for consideration of relevance.
Well, this case, of course, there's a dynamic turnoff, as I told you. This is the gene that turns itself off, and it's the other input is TCF, which also turns itself off. So, So that goes off, and that input is no longer necessary, as I showed you in that other slide, because by that time, OTX and gut E are locked in an embrace, and they stay on. And these things stay on. Yeah. But as you know, it can be, don't overdo that argument, because you can change the shape of that gradient and get a normal flyout. Well, that's true. As I said to you yesterday, when I think maybe it was you asked me the same version of the same question, I call these Boolinear systems, and they have Boolean logic gates, which have to be considered if you want to understand what they're really doing, and it's a fascinating aspect that logic is encoded in the genome in that sense. That is not to say that they don't have linear amplifications, like I showed you in Endo-16, literally. And they also have additive ORs, and sometimes they have multiple target sites, and you get more output than if you don't have multiple target sites. So of course, quantities of things are important, but in the forward drive of these systems as they develop, if you look at the kinetics of expression of two genes, one of which is upstream of the other, then as I said before, the second one goes on long before a steady state is achieved on the part of the first one. Long before. So it is, that means it's level insensitive just to turn on the next step of the cascade. So this is a system that's very different from running a mature pancreas, for example, where it has to respond very sensitively to levels of 30 different things in order to run its genes up to. Right? That's got a different kind of a level sensitivity. This is a system that's changing its state every few hours. There's not many messages of anything or proteins compared to what happens later in differentiation. That Endo-16 curve that I showed you, where remember yesterday the curve that went like that, that's a far downstream gene. And by the end of that, it's a differentiation gene. There's something, there's a humongous number of messenger RNAs per cell of that compared to the transcription factor that's running it. And so there's a huge dynamic range that isn't even touched at all of this regulatory system. It all runs at a rather low level, and it's level insensitive, basically. Yeah. Well, that's of course what you just try not to do, but it happens when you get a lousy morpholino, then you get no phenotype. That's exactly what you see. No, and you say, oh, but I see an effect when I look at the qPCR. There's no phenotype. So make another morpholino. Yes. So my view of multiple binding sites for the same factor is, since these systems are operating at a fairly low level, that means that they're largely, any given site is for much of the time unoccupied. So that means that there's a low probability of occupancy at the ambient transcription factor concentration. So if you multiply sites, you're simply linearly increasing the probability of occupancy, and that's what it looks like. Well, we've done those experiments, not as far as normal sea urchins, but as far as normal output of OTX reporter. That's a different thing, and it turns out that the sites are always different, and this is the same thing's been found for Bicoid sites and some Drosophila genes and other sites too. Sites are always different, and there's always some strong sites and some weak sites. And if you screw up the strong sites, you lose function completely, and the weak sites sort of help and don't do much. So I can't tell you a question that you probably want to know the answer to, which is, if I put an animal out in the wild with no weak sites as opposed to three weak sites, what difference would it make, plus two strong sites? I don't know the answer. It should. We haven't done it. Well, I didn't say amounts don't matter. I simply said that they matter. That since the system never runs at the point where the amount can be calibrated, which is a steady state, the amounts are continuously changing. And remember another thing: these are systems which will run perfectly healthily at very different temperatures. And the expression has a Q10 of about 2. So, I mean, the system as a whole, or any piece of it. So there's quite a lot of difference in rate at temperature, and it works perfectly well. So that's pretty interesting. That just tells you something about that same question you're asking. This thing? This thing, so this system works, and this is an example that I showed you the other day, is a canonical example of an AND processor. Remember that picture I showed with a tall bar and three little colored bars, which represented, I mean, I can find it in yesterday's talk if you want, you may remember it. It showed that if you take out any one of the outputs and leave all the others there, it's dead. It comes from, yeah, so, well, so what happens is it's a little tricky because there's two different cis regulatory modules involved here. And so the initial input gets this thing going, but it makes the same protein, which activates GATA E, and then it comes back, and by that time, so then everything works together. It's got two different, it's a cute little device. But you notice that sub-circuit that made the moving circle, that's a cute little device too. There's some wonderful system design aspects that you discover here. Yeah.
Although, and function
is
used by the ratio of 4
per device,
right?
Which?
And function.
Yes. And function, yes. That's not necessarily true. What is equally possible is that, in the first place, I'll show you this in my next talk when we discuss the evolution of this particular cis regulatory module, which we know something about. But it's true that the key sites which are the OTX and GATA E sites are close together, and they could bind cooperatively, but they also could do something else. And there's some evidence in the literature for this kind of thing as well, which is that the two proteins together serve as a platform on which a cofactor sits that actually does the interaction with the basal apparatus. And so that's a that would give you a perfect AND function. Without both of them, you get nothing. Cooperativity give you a steeper.
But that's obviously not a foolproof process because, you know, it could be leaky in the sense that if one input is leaking, then your implication energy might be
Not if it's the mechanism I just told you.
So your mechanism is that you have to have...
If I have two things sitting here and the platform on which this big co-activator sits needs both of them to be there at all, then that's what you get. Cooperativity, as you say, is a continuous function, and it doesn't actually give you that unless you have a very high cooperativity, like three or four proteins together, and then you get a steep curve.
But cofactors are not in the network, right?
No, they're not in the network because they're ubiquitous. No, they're not rate limiting. They're present there. What's rate limiting is the interaction with the DNA. Yes. Those are just mean that transcription factor target state's been mutated and authenticated. That's all. And unfortunately, these diagrams are taken from my book, so they're a year behind in diamonds. So, sorry about that. anyway. Well, we try to get a grant to put them in the three-dimensional computational representation of the lineage of the embryo. And the reviewers gave us the rest of the grant, but they said, don't do that project. So we haven't done it. We really want to, but that was the one project they picked on. They said it was unnecessary. We think it's necessary. I agree with you. I want to go on to one other thing now, which is this. So just for the, I think I have a few more minutes. Do I have a few more minutes? Yeah. So you'd like to know how much of what we're talking about is peculiar. Is this creepy sea urchin peculiarity? And so we don't have much network information, but we have some. We have a little bit. We have a beautiful dorsoventral network from Drosophila. I don't know. How complete do you think that is? Yeah. What? Oh, I think it's pretty complete, but I don't know it as well as you know. So, anyway, there's a very good, and it's much. Some of it, at least a good part, has been authenticated at this regulatory level. There's a partial network for a piece of Xenopus embryonic mesoderm development, and there's some C. elegans networks, but there really isn't much, and so there are a few other networks on it. But it's amazing to me that even with the little that we know, there are features that pop out that are sub-circuit wiring principles, so to speak, that are worth considering. And they're already apparent, even though we're just at the beginning of network practice and theory. And so what is a definition of this is that we're interested in common architecture, because my contention is it's the architecture of the subcircuits that has a functional meaning, not the biochemistry. So what that means is that I want to see the same architecture doing the same job, but using different transcription factors, perhaps, or not dependent on the biochemical peculiarities of one given factor. So I'm going to show you a few. So here's one case. So it became apparent to us, which we weren't looking for either, as we went through the Searchin network, that in one domain after another, the specification of each domain results in a activation of a specific repressor that prevents expression of a transcription factor that would be needed for another specification process to occur. And so you might say, what? You might rightly say that. And we found this first in looking at just the genes I was talking about, and one of the genes in that five gene kernel was FOXA. Well, FOXA turns out, as we discovered to our surprise, when we knocked its expression off, we saw that GCM expression went up. But that just didn't make any sense, because GCM is expressed in the mesoderm and FOXA is expressed in the endoderm. Why should FOXA bother turning off GCM? And the reason actually is that GCM goes on, as I told you, in response to a notch signal. Well, later on, delta, the notch ligand, is expressed in the mesoderm, and the endoderm cells receive that signal. They use it for their own purposes, but they don't want GCM to go on, so it's a, probably control against that. But this is actually very general. And here are examples from all over the place. A C. elegans example, two Drosophila examples, two mouse examples, a Xenopsis example. And they all look the same. In every case, there's a state of specification that's shown in black. There's a one of the genes that's expressed in consequence thereof acts as a repressor. And there's a target gene downstream that is repressed that represents an alternative state of specification if it were allowed to be expressed. And there are examples from many different systems. Yes. Say what? Well, yeah. In the case that I gave you, yes. It's not always true. It's in the case of these cardiac cells in Drosophila, it is true. In the case of the sensory cells, it is true. It's sometimes true, but it can also be that the genes might be subject to some signal that they're not wanted to respond to, whether they're actually adjacent or not. But it's just seen over and over again. The players are always different, but the architecture is the same. We call this the exclusion phenomenon. Every time a state of specification is defined, it turns on a repressor that attacks an upstream regulator of an alternative state of specification. That's kind of interesting. So if you... Well, so this is very important. So we did an experiment where we forced a skeletogenic cell to turn into a pigment cell by putting in pigment cell specification apparatus. So it turned off skeletogenic functions. It wasn't a confused cell. So it's very important, because a lot of us are interested in the possibility of being able to, at will, re-engineer specification states. And so the way to do that is to put in the right regulatory apparatus. If you got a confused cell out, you'd be doomed to fail. But because of this phenomenon, you don't get a confused cell out. You get a cell that goes one way or it goes the other way. So what happens, for example, in the FOXA? In the FOXA case, if you block FOXA from repressing GCM, then you get, eventually you get pieces of, you get piece of what should be gut becoming pigment cells. So it hurts. No, just the ones that just not all at all. And it's because of what I said, it's the ones that are exposed to that notch signal. No. GCM in turn shuts off skeletogenic functions by repressing ALX1. And in sea urchins, there's an interesting phenomenon, which is that late in development, if you take out the skeletogenic cells, then other mesodermal cells will replace them and turn to skeletogenic cells. It turns out that that's mediated through release of repression on ALX1. So this phenomenon has the overall system property of sharpening cell fate choices. Okay, here's another one. So on what? Well, repression is usually dominant, and so that means that at whatever level the repressed genes integrate over time. So because the repression complexes seem to be stable, and so it's the least level sensitive example you could pick. Activation is much more level sensitive. So here's another one. I showed you that feedback system where I said this, the genes are locked in a regulatory embrace. And that's a lockdown circuitry. It's not made by methylating or demethylating chromatin or anything. It means that those genes have to continuously be firing and making RNA and making protein and the genes have to be running. Is that a regular thing in specification? Well, it sure is. This is the one you just saw. Here's an oral ectoderm network that we're just working out. Same thing. So this gene turns on this gene feeds back on it, and these guys are upstream of a whole bunch of other things. This is in Drosophila. It's a different kind of a lockdown, but it certainly has a dynamic lockdown, which is single-minded regulating itself. And I could show you from other networks, many cases of this, and I think one of the biggest generalities of wiring is that there's dynamic lockdown circuitry. That's how states of specification are stabilized. Another, what I would call, principle of regulatory circuitry is what I call a community effect, which has a particular wiring. And I showed you an example with that Wnt8 system, but it's a general case, but it's always done with different, it's often done with very different signaling systems where in fact it defines what a tissue is, I think, in animals. Every cell in a tissue communicates to every other cell, and the mechanism is always an input onto the gene that encodes the ligand, which responds to the same signal transduction system that the ligand activates in the recipient cell. So here's the Wnt8 one that you saw before. But here's one from Xenopus that uses a completely different ligand, which is EFGF, and it activates some signal transduction system, which turns on a regulatory gene, which runs EFGF. So the result is the same as here. Every cell expresses a ligand in this domain and communicates to the neighboring cells. And the same thing is here in the oral ectoderm of the sea urchin. Again, a different ligand, in this case nodal. Every cell expresses it, but it itself is driven by SMAD factors, which are activated by reception of nodal. So every cell expresses and receives it. And so all the cells, so what does it mean? It means And downstream of that are many other genes, like here, that have to be running in order for that state of specification to exist. So the regulatory state of the tissue depends on continuous communication between the cells. Mechanistically depends on, and the wiring feature that's in common is the ligand gene. That's a generality. Yes. You ask me? Oh. This kind of obvious that a lot of signaling is inductive. The target's always is always a regulatory gene. Here's a case in Xenopus. Here's a case in Drosophila. Here's a case in sea urchins. Differentiation genes are wired similarly. They always, for example, here's three differentiation gene batteries, which in which the protein coding genes are shown in blue and the regulators are in red. Well, what's similar is always they're always multiple. They usually cross-regulate either immediately upstream or amongst themselves. And these are three entirely different systems with similar wiring. Another thing I might point out about differentiation gene batteries is they're very frequently feed-forward circuits. Anyway, I think of these as what you might call design principles for network subcircuits for development. And there are many more to be discovered, but I'm sure the repertoire will be confined. And these are the building blocks that developmental apparatus has been created out of in evolution. So there's also the level of design principles, which I haven't discussed, which is cis-regulatory design. And there's something else that we don't know anything about, really, which is what will be the design features of subcircuits that do morphogenesis, that make tubes, that make crawling sheets of cells, that do the things that produce the 3D forms. Those are also batteries of cytoskeletal and genes and other kinds of motility genes and cell adhesion genes. But we really don't know anything about the architecture of subcircuits that control them for any system, hardly. So that's a frontier that needs to be filled in. So anyway, I think I'll stop there. Yes. I think the fate being it, so what happens in development, as you know, is at the stage of specification, is that cells which could go this way or could go that way or could go the other way, by means of imposition of an autonomous or external cue, turn on or start to create a regulatory state of their own. So the states that are excluded are those which could have been taken by the cell at the stage that the specification occurred. Now that's not all states, because there's always a branching tree of possibilities. Well, not necessarily a lineage. It could be a next door cell that might get the same signal that this cell got. But it's a state that could have been obtained by, that could have been attained by that cell had, for example, the obverse occurred and that state of specification been excluded. Now, that's not all states. For instance, it might be a mesodermal state as opposed to an endoderm state, but those have common ancestors. Or it might be one hematopoietic state as opposed to another hematopoietic state. And it's a very good example as I could have put in here in mouse hematopoietic cells. For example, PAX5 and B cells excludes at least two other fates of other hematopoietic cells by exactly the same kind of mechanism. But those cells can be made to go that way. It may very well, yes. Nonetheless, it's kind of amazing you can draw the same picture for all these different situations. And I think it's really important for the cleanliness of regulatory state decisions and specification. You mean the egg? You mean if you take, it's just a blah, yeah. I think the only thing like that is in cleavage stage cells in which the beta catenin TCF input's been taken out, so none of these specification systems can start. And you get this ball of cells. I used to say it's a ball of ectoderm, maybe I said that, but that's wrong. It doesn't actually express ectoderm genes either. But that's perfectly reasonable because we know that TCF beta catenin input goes into upper level genes in all parts of that system. After I've been sitting there for 2 days, I don't know if that's true, but yeah.
Everything happens so slowly that by the time your starting gene gets both direct signal and indirect signal, direct signal may be gone. So why then?
Well, in this case, the direct signal isn't gone, and so you get A goes to B, B goes to C, and A goes to C. And these are, in case of the differentiation genes, I could show you a slew of them, but I didn't bring the slide. But they're actually they're additive ORs. And so that's one aspect of it. They're diverse step-up mechanisms, and so in an additive OR, the biochemical meaning of it may be, for example, that one transcription factor activates a histone deacetylase and another transcription factor tickles a TAF or something. And so they give different ways of stimulating transcription. They're typically seen when genes want to really run hard. Which is the case in terminal differentiation. And also upstream of both A and B are liable to be different inputs. So there's both an aspect of having different regulatory pathways that make this thing run. But in addition, different controls on when it's going to run. So it's both an informational checkpoint and a level stabilizer, level driver. I know. For me, those speculations are not relevant to this kind of a system. How about you?